Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This program is brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
This week on Rewind, your week in review. Wisconsin Democrats hold their annual convention, and the Supreme Court weighs in on a state scholarship program for minority students. Plus, liberal activist Kirk Bengstad's Minocqua Brewery sues the Department of Revenue. All that and more on Rewind, your week in review for June 19th.
I'm Anya Van Wagtendonk.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
Welcome to Rewind. We're going to start actually this past weekend rather than earlier this week, because it was the Democratic State Convention. Always an exciting roundup of the most excited Democrats in the state. That was here in Madison. What were some of your takeaways?
Big thing was kind of the focus on the race for governor and the pitches that the candidates made. So, 7-person field, 5-minute speeches each on a Sunday afternoon. You're really the hardest of hardcore Democrats. You stuck around till Sunday morning, listened to speeches for 35 minutes on a beautiful day inside a dark room. But the summary, the quick rundown, Sarah Rodriguez, if you want to be the damn man, I'm the damn person to do it. It's kind of her money line. Joel Brennan, this is our chance to close a door fully in the Scott Walker area. David Crowley, a black man, can win statewide in Wisconsin, and I'm the one because I have a record. Kel DeRoy's, I don't just have bullet points. I've got bills, I've got experience. Mandela Barnes called Tom Tiffany a coward, for emphasis. Francesca Hahn said that voters can smell BS, and that the people who say that I'm unrealistic or unelectable, says something about Nelson Gaylord, Bob La Follette, these kind of like Val Phillips luminaries in Wisconsin progressive politics. And Ms. Hughes basically said, I'm the one that can produce good business environment in Wisconsin. We need good businesses to have good resources that produce good social policy. So there's your rundown. I don't know that this pitch they made shook up the field at all. It kind of like just, there's their talking points from their forums, but it begins a sprint now over the next month and a half toward like really having a clear picture of what's happening. So we'll talk later about the Wisconsin Politics straw poll that we had at convention. We're going to get finance reports July 15th. That'll give us a first real look at the finances in 6 months. Who's raising the money? Who has money to go up on TV? Who doesn't? Who's got a path and who does not? We're going to get a new Marquette Law School poll sometime after that. We'll bring some clarity, at least a talking point about where the field is at. And then the debate, July 28th. That date's very important because early voting begins that day. And so we've got this first kind of like spark, then these data points coming up that'll really set the field. And if anybody's bet wrong in how they're approaching this primary, come July 28th, it's going to be too late to fix it. They're going to have to hold on for dear life about 2 weeks of the race.
Yeah, I mean, to your point, one of the things I was looking for was just kind of, is anyone going to really kind of distinguish themselves at this event? And not really. I mean, there was a lot of, like you say, there were these kind of like money moments. Like, I'm surprised that nobody's made the damn man pun before. but, you know, a lot of talk about affordability, a lot of kind of broad brushstrokes about how they will achieve that in ways that are like not even entirely up to a governor's discretion. And so also a lot of talk about like how they will need, you know, Democrats to take over, to get the trifecta, if you will. And so a lot of kind of, you know, we will get there, like if all of these things kind of line up well, then we will be able to achieve this vision. Meanwhile, Tom Tiffany just more or less has this feel to himself where he doesn't even really have to make those types of promises. He can just be kind of like a normal aw shucks kind of guy in his own advertising. And so there's like a really kind of so much jostling that needs to go on among the Democrats, obviously compared to one man.
Can't forget the Tony Evers goodbye show, essentially. So Saturday night was like kind of like his moment. Mark Buchanan and Gwen Moore spoke, and Diane Hasselbein. Greta Neubauer has a new child, Ingrid, born a week or so before the convention. She spoke via video. At Sarah Galuski speak. But it was really kind of Evers' night to say, hey, here's my career, my 8 years in office. I'm kind of wrapping this thing up, a couple of holy mackerels and gosh darn dolly geez. And then some shots at Tom Tiffany. He's kind of preparing to pass the baton to the next person. We've talked about Governor Evers and the tension he's felt with some of the people in the field, with Democratic lawmakers after the whole surplus deal fell apart. But he is raising money for the party for this fund to then help the next nominee to go after Tom Tiffany and really kind of propel that person toward November. That was worthy of note. Also, Sunday morning, they had a debate about resolutions and the Constitution. I don't know what you took away from the weekend, but most of the messaging from the podium was about affordability, about Trump's bad, Tiffany's part Trump, and they made everything more expensive. So that was kind of a good message, you know, on message for Democrats. I'm not really talking about social stuff or getting distracted by other things, really focused on that. During the Sunday morning debate, they talked about resolutions, and it was usually the red meat for the base of, like, abolish ICE, things like that that aren't necessarily as popular with the public, and those things that Tom Tiffany was kind of seizing upon to say, hey, these guys are out of touch.
But then also, I was really paying attention to what they might do around data centers. That's been an area, as we've talked about so many times, that hasn't really been defined in a partisan way quite yet. And so it's also interesting to see how the party and how the candidates are kind of approaching that. So one of the big applause lines from the speeches was Fran Hong saying, I am the only candidate who opposes data centers. It's interesting. I went for a separate story. I went to a rally that she was holding on that same beautiful day. People were inside of the Atwood Music Hall. And multiple people that I talked to said the reason that they support her is her stance on data centers. So it's really interesting to seeing, you know, what is kind of coming to the fore on this. And then, again, as you say, as money is starting to be spent. So we just saw, I believe last week, Joel Brennan launched this big ad campaign, again, kind of, you know, talking about the Walker era, really putting, like, juxtaposing himself to that. And then Kelda Roy's now is launching, I think, a $500,000 ad buy as well.
So I don't want to diminish a $500,000, but in a race like this, we're trying to rebuild your name ID statewide. That is not a sustained TV buy. Now, Roy says she's targeting Democratic primary voters, also targeting areas to pull voters away from other candidates. Okay, maybe. What I'm skeptical about is, go back to 2022, Mandela Barnes had the most name ID in the race for U.S. Senate. Alex Lazary spent $14 million, $14 million of his own money mostly, on ads or on the campaign, and got close to Mandela until Mandela began to spend and then couldn't catch him. What's going on here in this race that anybody's spending enough money or their outside groups to really build their name ID a lot? And granted, you can target people, you know, digital buys and those kinds of things, but it's just not enough yet. So when's the flood going to come? Have they all got conserving every dollar they can to like the last few weeks? And it's going to be a mad rush to the doors to try and get ads out? I don't know, but there's nothing happening yet financially that makes you go, this race is going to explode anytime soon.
And, you know, you mentioned the kind of Evers swan song. One thing that was also interesting about that is that it comes on the heels of this kind of division in the party over the property tax and school funding deal. And there was a really big show, especially from Diane Hasselbein, around, you know, sort of no hard feelings, no bad blood, you know, everybody kind of wanting to really convey unity, which I thought was, you know, it makes sense going into an election year. That's obviously the Republicans are very focused on that at their convention. Diane Hasselbein also gave a WISP Politics luncheon this week in Madison and talked again a little bit about some of those putting aside any suggestion of troubles in the Democratic Party. And she was also asked to address this kind of concern among some Democrats that when Democrats do have control, if they do get that trifecta, that they can't actually govern, that when they had it in, you know, in 2010, they didn't quite know what to do with it. So we have a little bit of video of her talking about that now.
Do you feel like you have to I guess prove something to people who say that?
I believe that if we are fortunate enough to get a Democratic trifecta, that we are going to be able to put common sense policies out there that are going to make sense, that are going to improve people's lives, and they're going to be able to feel it and see it by the next April election, and definitely by that fall, by passing a budget that the people of the state of Wisconsin want, need, and deserve. I believe that we can do that. I believe we have the policies in place. I am excited to get to work. And I can guarantee you we're not going to be putting something out there that's going to bring tens of thousands of protesters coming to our state capitol. We are going to be working in a smart, pragmatic way that the state of Wisconsin demands us to be.
So again, you know, Democrats are really kind of seizing on this idea that there will be a blue wave and that people are ready for change and that a trifecta is in sight. They just need, you know, to flip two seats in the Senate and five in the Assembly and hold on to the governor's office and hold on to all their existing seats in both of those chambers. What did you take away from that conversation?
You know, Democrats have reason to be optimistic about the environment we're in right now. There are reasons to be concerned. You know, the National Republicans have a lot of money, a lot more money than Democrats do. That money filters down to the locals. So, yes, the state Democratic Party has been great at raising money, but will the national Republican groups come in and, like, be able to offset that? We shall see. Gas dropped below $4 a gallon this past week. The Iran war seems to be winding. I'm not a foreign policy expert, so I'm not going to really weigh in on that one. But it impacts domestic policy, and gas is such a simplistic way to look at things, but it's true. When people are paying more for gas, they feel more economically stressed. When it's lower, they feel better. So I saw like a social media post in the White House this week, like, gas below $4 a gallon, like, trust Trump. It's like, but what Trump did caused it to go above $4 a gallon. So will voters be less concerned about the economy come October? That's all like to be determined. But for Democrats, you know, the mess affordability, like, can they make that case? Can they drive it home? Do they have the resources to do it? And how's their candidate quality? Everybody says they're a great candidate when they file June 1st. When they actually get into the debate and their backgrounds are exposed, that's when we know if they're a great candidate or not.
The other thing that kind of jumped out to me from that luncheon was that she said essentially, like, yeah, I'd be willing to revisit some kind of deal, even though she was not included in the negotiations over the previous deal, but that no one has approached her. And so it kind of seems to indicate that it does not seem like something is going to happen in that realm anytime soon.
I think we did talk about the show that if Devin Lemieux wants to go out and lobby three of his colleagues to change their votes, it might happen. If Governor Evers wants to go out and lobby 15 Democrats to change their votes, it might happen, but that's not happening.
Yeah, I mean, what we saw was, again, a sort of show of unity from these Senate Democrats, and I think that Diane was kind of hinting at that unity is still there. Also this week, there was the annual Juneteenth celebration. I believe it's the seventh time that they've raised the Juneteenth flag over the Capitol. And this is kind of interesting, you know, coming obviously in the context of changes to how Juneteenth is acknowledged at the federal level. And so there was a little bit of sort of references to that in the speeches at this event. And so we will take a look at some video from that event.
It is my pleasure again to welcome you all as we celebrate our history and our emancipation. What freedom looks like yesterday, today, and tomorrow is this year's theme because it demonstrates our community's ongoing struggle for liberation, equity, and the human dignity that all of God's children deserve. The countless stories of our ancestors throughout our history vary because the Black experience has never been as simple as our history textbooks attempt to make it. Our struggle for liberation and dignity meant our ancestors had to be grounded and rooted in joy in order to believe that their struggles would free Black lives for the future generations they would never meet. And now this mantle rests on us. So the message we want all of Wisconsin and our nation to share is quite simple. You can't take away joy because we know our ongoing struggles will not compare to the freedoms our future will have. And we will never be truly free until all Black lives are free.
So I think that's also, you know, an opportunity for Democrats in part to be having some of these events to show culturally also what they will kind of bring to the fore, right? There's been fights over acknowledging Black History Month over the last couple of years, Juneteenth, Pride Month. There's been like sort of fights over which flags can be raised over the Capitol. And so I think this is something that Democrats are also kind of showcasing, that they will continue to bring those kind of cultural elements if they are in power, and certainly if a Democrat remains governor. Speaking of people who will not be governor, Kirk Bangstad. So he has had quite a couple of weeks, and we've talked about him quite a bit. This is obviously the Minocqua Brewery owner, liberal activist, provocateur, was running for governor, didn't submit enough signatures, said he was going to sue to get on the ballot, is no longer going to sue to get on the ballot. Instead, he is suing the Department of Revenue, which last week seized, I believe, 1,200 cans of beer from him. He estimates that about $25,000 worth, over $500 in unpaid excise taxes having to do with the way that he brews his beer. He uses contract brewers in Illinois. He says that he paid the tax in Illinois and he got confused and he should have done it in Wisconsin. But now he is suing the Department of Revenue to get his beer back, also implying that Governor Tony Evers personally weaponized the DOR against him because he's very critical of Evers, that the DOR is reading his emails, and that the Tavern League, which is a Republican entity, is also maybe in cahoots with the governor. Like, a lot of out there claims.
A lot of theories. Yes, so Kirk is now in court. I'm, again, not a lawyer, not going to weigh in on that. More interesting to me was this kind of pattern with him where I talked to him on Tuesday of last week, and he said, I am going to sue to get on the ballot. If there's a way, we're going to fight it. as a podcast Wednesday night, I believe, and just says, there's not a, I'm giving up my fever dream, essentially, of joining the ballot. This came together too quickly. I'm not going to do it. I'm just unhappy because the Democrats running for governor aren't focused enough on Trump and what he's trying to do. So, again, a lot of, like, puffery from Kirk and then kind of nothing in the end, for what it's worth.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the other kind of piece of this is the way that he has been using some of these controversies to kind of drum up attention for himself. He is selling merchandise, likening himself to Al Capone, I noticed. And I also, you know, I wasn't around in Wisconsin during 2020, so I did not know, but I recently learned that he had a whole beer line mm-hmm. devoted to celebrating Governor Tony Evers. And so it's interesting that he has swung so far into, you know, criticizing these sort of corporate Democrats, as he calls them.
I think he's also got new T-shirts printed that make light of the fact that his beer was confiscated, so maybe he's a marketing genius, if nothing else.
Yeah, exactly. Certainly people do sometimes buy those T-shirts. We also got today, we are taping on Thursday, this will air on Friday, but today the Wisconsin Supreme Court released an interesting decision in this case around retention grants for certain minority students in the UW system. And what was interesting about this, I think it was kind of telegraphed mm-hmm. for a while what the actual decision was going to be. It hinges on a decision out of the U.S. Supreme Court that basically says that, you know, you can't make race-based decisions when it comes to higher education. And this appeals court had ruled, you know, along those lines. And the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the appeals court. They upheld that ruling. But what was interesting here is that you have the conservative justices writing the opinion alongside Janet Protasiewicz, and then the three other liberal justices concurring, but their concurrences did not sound mm-hmm. like concurrences.
So first you have Jill Karofsky, who basically said, I'm bound by this U.S. Supreme Court precedent. I'm not happy about it, though. I don't like that ruling. I've got issues with it. And she went after it on the 14th Amendment and these other things basically were about trying to address slavery and the shameful history of our country with that and trying to equalize the lives of black Americans who had been slaved for so long. And in her words, it's been weaponized to go the other direction, to not really address these things, and she lamented what's going on. So that was kind of interesting. And then you had Becca Dallet with a different concurring opinion saying, look, yeah, the Higher Education Aides Board didn't really make its case under this law, like this new standard from the U.S. Supreme Court. Other programs could make their case to justify race being a factor. So she's kind of saying, hey, just because we're not doing this program doesn't mean every race-based thing in state government is going to get thrown out the window. That's worth noting because Wisconsin for Law and Liberty, which represented the people who sued in this case, they seized upon the decision to say, hey, this means taxpayers can sue any race-based program in Wisconsin. This is our path to doing this. Another footnote, Dora Drake, a state lawmaker from Milwaukee, said, hey, I got these grants. I was at Marquette. This is not a good thing. I'm going to introduce a bill to recast the program to focus on things like your zip code to still serve disadvantaged students rather than on race to make it constitutional.
Right. I mean, one of the pieces that the people that Will argued was that the Southeast Asian kind of community that is eligible for these grants, it has to do with which country your family came from after the Vietnam War, essentially. And so they were saying, right, like that is picking and choosing kind of winners and losers. The other thing that, you know, somebody I spoke to mentioned that I thought was interesting is that the court could have ruled very widely or very narrowly. And in this case, they ruled very narrowly. So rather than ruling in a way that would make it so that Will would not have to keep filing lawsuits about every race-based thing in Wisconsin, they essentially just said, no, this program is unconstitutional. So opening the door to many more lawsuits rather than setting a blanket precedent. Mm-hmm. So very interesting. Some more legal news this week. We talk a lot about the false electors case from 2020, and 5.5 years later, it is ongoing. So we had the arraignment in the felony forgery case against Jim Troupas, Mike Roman, and Ken Chesbro. They each pleaded guilty in Dane County Circuit Court this week. Jim Troupas in person, the other two virtually. What's the latest with this case?
Oh, so pleaded not guilty.
Did I say guilty?
Yes.
Oh, gosh.
Yes.
Not guilty.
Correction there.
Yikes.
But so not guilty. Really, the thing is, this is just setting up to like the bigger issue, which is Troupas says, I'm shielded from this prosecution because the president gave a blanket pardon to anybody involved in false elector schemes. That's a federal pardon, not a state pardon. These are state charges, but he argues that counting of the ballots is a federal process, therefore the state can't prosecute him. and he wants it moved to Jefferson County, which you'd assume why, because Jefferson County went for Trump by like 40 or 50 points, whereas he lost, or 17 points, he lost Dane County by like a lot. So much better environment, you would argue, for Troupas in Jefferson County than in Dane County.
Yeah, and he also argued that, you know, the one of the arguments that the state is making is that everybody in Dane County whose ballot got recounted is like a victim of this crime, and so you can't be heard by a jury of victims of your crime, or alleged victims, I suppose I should say. So that's interesting. The judge said that he'd continue to consider those motions, so it's possible that things will happen. It's also just kind of, I think, the latest delay tactic by his team. You know, they filed those motions suggesting that the judge wasn't writing his own orders and things like this. And so really just kind of kicking the can.
So 11 motions to dismiss have been rejected at this point. Now, it also is delayed because Josh Call took 4 years to charge anybody. Like, there's that foundation. And now we're 2 years and 2 months later and still in, yeah, so. Been a while.
And, you know, who knows what will happen in the Attorney General's race. So that's also a question there. A little bit more sort of breaking as of Thursday news. Salah Sarsour, who is the president of the largest mosque in Wisconsin, the Islamic Society of Milwaukee, he was arrested by ICE 10 weeks ago, 2.5 months ago. He's been in detention in Indiana. And then early this morning, a federal judge there, a Trump-appointed federal judge in the district court in southern Indiana, ordered that he must be released. So there's kind of two components to this. One is his immigration case that's going on in Chicago. And then separately, his legal team filed a habeas petition and a motion for immediate release. So this is the motion for immediate release. It basically, the judge said that they make a really good argument that potentially his First Amendment rights have been violated. So his team is arguing that he's been targeted for being a pro-Palestinian activist on the basis of free and protected speech, and also that his health has declined. They said that he's lost about 30 pounds in detention in 10 weeks. And so the judge said, you know, I'm not ruling on the merits of the habeas petition just yet, but I am saying that you make a substantive claim that he might be, this might be retaliation for free speech. So he was let go this afternoon. I spoke with his lawyers. They said he was picked up by two of his sons about 2:30 this afternoon. The immigration case, his next hearing is next week, or it's scheduled to be next week. It sounds like we will now see whether that's going to get postponed because of this decision. And then the judge in this case is also going to weigh in on the habeas petition. So it's interesting. In some ways, it mirrors the Mahmoud Khalil case, the Columbia University student in New York. And so interesting to kind of just see that come ashore. The other interesting piece, and I don't entirely know what to make of this just yet, but his lawyer pointed out to me that his immigration case should be taking place in Chicago and technically is, but now it's being overseen by a sort of number two in Trump's immigration cabinet. So could potentially be, again, a sort of precedent-setting or really attention-grabbing case. So lots to pay attention to there. And that brings us to stocks this week. We mentioned the straw poll from the convention. Sara Rodriguez was the big winner.
So let's get it out there. Straw polls are a gauge of the base of the base of the base. So we had 1,100 people at convention. 600 people voted. Sara won with like 27% of the vote. Hong was at 23. So let's be honest. That's 600 people. We might see 600,000 vote in August. So take it for what it is, especially when you realize that Kelda Royce won the straw poll in 2018. Tony Evers finished third. But to Sara's credit, this is a sign of like organization, right? I mean, she obviously was shepherding supporters to convention. It was in the backyard of Kelda Royce and Francesca Hong. Hong finished second, Royce third, because in Madison, probably played a role there. Sara's more from like Waukesha County. She is, you know, more of the kind of establishment pick. This is more of a liberal crowd. So all in all, nice showing for her. The question is, does she have the resources or does her backers have the resources to make it really do something? So that's the next big thing. Other note about stock, the straw poll. Mandela Barnes finished sixth out of seven people. That was a little eye-opening. And I've asked people like all week, like, what's going on? And the theory is that, you know, Mandela's been running a kind of a general election campaign almost from day one, focused on Tom Tiffany. And he may have this calculation correct, that nobody can catch him because of his name ID. He won't spend until he has to, like the last couple, 3 weeks, just do enough to kind of get across the finish line. Keep all your stuff focused on Tom Tiffany. He's moderated some things. If you listen to his speeches, some of his answers and interviews, a little bit different tack they took in 2022. It's all about that general election. And that might be the right. It might be right. Again, Alex Lazary, $14 million, couldn't catch him. What if he's wrong, though? Again, finance reports July 15th. If Mandela's not, like, blown away the pack, what's that going to tell you? Marquette poll sometime after that. If Mandela's not leading the pack by a lot, what's that tell you? The debate July 28th. That's a moment for all these candidates to create a viral moment, good or bad, that could be the last image that voters have going to the primary. So there's a time for Mandela to kind of really put this thing away. It's the next month. And if he doesn't, okay, can Francesca Hong win? Can Sarah Rodriguez win? You go down the list of other folks, we've not seen really evidence of Missy Hughes or Joel Brennan or David Crowley breaking through. Yeah, Kella's doing $500,000, hasn't shown up yet. So when's it going to start? I don't want to diminish $500,000. I don't have it in my checking account. But it's not a lot of money for an ad campaign. So as we see those finance reports come in, as we see that Marquette poll, will anybody go, I'm not sure about this race anymore? And if you're Sarah Rodriguez, you have a better chance of beating Hong and Barn, coalescing that, like, I don't say anti-Hong-Barnes vote, more like the not-Barnes-Hong vote. If you don't have Missy Hughes and Joel Brennan, David Crowley and Kelda Royce to compete with. At the same time, all those folks are going, you know, there's all this kind of like backroom chatter about some of these candidates and flaws they might have. What if Mandela implodes in the last month of the race? I'm not going to drop out, because if he implodes or Francesca implodes, somebody's going to benefit from that. It might be me. So they're all staking in. It's kind of an interesting kind of like situation, what's going on.
And, you know, nobody really anointed by the establishment. By contrast, Rebecca Cook, who is mixed this week, very much kind of backed by national Democrats especially.
And the irritation of that came through a convention. So Sunday morning they had debates about resolutions and also about the Constitution, and it governs how the party operates. There's a provision right now that the state, basically local units of the party, cannot endorse in primaries. So like your county parties, your congressional district parties, they can't endorse. Okay. The DCCC, Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, can, and it has. It has put Rebecca Cook on his Red to Blue program. She's benefiting from that. She's outraised Derek Van Orden back-to-back quarters. Look, she's probably going to win the primary, all right, barring something crazy. Just the resources that she has over to Emmy Burge, who is a city councilwoman from Eau Claire, she's an odds-on favorite. Like, let's just be honest. But the fact that they had a provision or debate briefly about, we want to change the Constitution to allow us to endorse, but only the nationals do. We want to send a message, DCCC, stay out of our primaries, stop doing this, we don't like it, and you're irritating the grassroots. Now, the question becomes, let's say Cook wins in August. Will those grassroots who are irritated by this say, you know what, I'm so irritated, I'm not going to vote for Rebecca Cook, when Derek Van Orden is the guy on the ballot? Like, they can't stand Derek Van Orden. So who do they dislike the most? Van Orden or the DCCC? Fascinating question to watch. But it gets at, we've been hearing for weeks about Cook, is she's got this great national profile, and the national media and everybody else focused on that. At home, she's got work to do. And that's a reality for between now and November, assuming she wins a primary.
And then falling this week, Hannah Dugan, the former judge, Judge Lynn Edelman this week, who could have revisited her conviction, chose not to.
So Lynn Edelman, you know, former Democratic lawmaker, probably the most liberal member of the Eastern District Judiciary, maybe her best shot to overturn her verdict, said, no, you're not going to do this. And it's really technical what a pending proceeding is and whether she interfered the pending proceeding. There's another case out of, I think, Virginia that dealt with this definition and it was overturned, the conviction. Her legal team saying, hey, look what happened over here. We're the same boat. Edelman basically said, no, it's not the same. Like, what she did is not the same as what happened over here. I'm rejecting this. So now the question is, they delayed sentencing while she appealed this to Edelman. Now that he said no, do they go ahead and take the, you know, go get sentenced? And because, I mean, she's a former judge, nonviolent offender, first time offense. You could argue time served or like probation. So I don't know that Edelman can throw the book at her. Or do you keep appealing and it'll get all wiped out? I mean, she did lose her career as a judge. You know, she is a convicted felon as we speak. But if you go do the appeal process, what happens if Edelman is down the bench at some point, is 85 years old, and somebody else gets your case when it comes back after the appeals process, and then maybe they throw the book at you, right? So there's some risk there, but yeah, not a great thing for her with this week. This ruling, take away 1 ounce of hope for her about getting to overturn this thing.
And that'll do it for Rewind this week. I am Anya Van Wagtentalk.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
See you next week.
This program was brought to you from the Margaret Farrell Studio.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.